everybody. My name is Ben Putley. This is Lab Talks Live. It's my absolute pleasure today to be joined by Robbie Young. Robbie, would you like to introduce yourself for us?
Sure. Hi, I'm Robbie. I'm the CEO of investments for Animoca Brands. And for those of you who don't know us, we're, I guess, a reasonably well-known company in the Web3 space. We began as a gaming and entertainment company, and then in recent years have, you know, I guess been better known for our investing activity. We're actually one of the most active investors in the Web3 space. We have a portfolio of about 550 companies across pretty much every category. I mean, as I like to say in a sort of pithy fashion, if it has a token, we're interested in it.
Okay, yeah.
And that's, I think, really going back to the sort of theme of our investing strategy, which is we really believe in this idea that tokens are kind of the incarnation of network effects. And that's what we think is really exciting about Web3.
Yeah, I think it might have been your, I think it was at the House of Commons last week when you were talking about if something's tokenized, that there can really be a swap between any token. And I think you don't often see, like, everything seems to be denominated in USDT, right? And that's probably quite limiting in terms of the potential for where tokenization can really go, given that tokens often share a standard. What do you think is the reason that hasn't been happening more? Like, why don't you see more token to token pairs?
So I think starting with stablecoins, obviously that's the first application within or use case within crypto or Web3 that has really found product market fit, as we call it. Because there are lots of people around the world who would love to use US dollars, but don't have a simple way to do that in their own banking and financial systems. And so stablecoins allow them to do that on a peer-to-peer basis.
Yeah.
I mean, anecdotally, I've heard stories from lots of people who are quite familiar with the Nigerian market, for example, that, you know, stablecoins are being widely used for things like market transactions, not financial markets, but actually going and buying vegetables and groceries and things like that, because it gives them access to a currency that might have a more stable, you know, inflation perspective. I think that in our industry, we haven't seen so much interoperability. Number one, because it's hard, but number two, because the concept is so new to people, because we have been building software for the better part of 50 years in walled gardens, where a software application is thought of something that just stands alone as an island. And not just because it has technical limitations of doing that, but also because that's how we have a relationship with our customer base.
Yeah.
Because the idea is that we build this walled garden, bring our customers into it, and try to maintain them inside this walled garden and service them as long as possible. And as software moved from something that we paid for in advance to something that we consume as a service, the idea of walling that garden ever higher becomes more important.
Yeah, I think it does seem like a safer bet to move into stablecoins. You know, there is like a degree of, I think, given that the premise of a blockchain is that it is trustless, I think when you have two variable assets on either side of a pair, that does require you then to have some trust in that other asset that you are marking your own token against. Is something that we have thought about, and like, we've had Ethereum pairs in the past and we have Bitcoin pairs as kind of like the two bluest of the chips, if you look at it that way. But I think there is a degree of risk as a project that has a token when you do think about pairing it with other tokens. I think that's why we've always erred towards stable coins. But I think particularly in kind of your world, if you look at, I'm sure a lot of the games that you have do have some kind of tokenization aspect to it, and have a token within the game that you can earn. As an ad company, I think that presents quite an interesting value exchange where you can either earn tokens in exchange for ads that have seen, and or buy ads with the native token using our token. It does create a better means of transacting more on chain, which I think solves a lot of issue on the monetization of apps, websites, TVs in general. But we can come to that. I'd be interested to hear just how you got into Web3.
Sure.
You mentioned before it was media first, and then now Web3.
Well, actually, it was, I guess, Web1 first.
Yeah.
Okay. So Web1 was what sort of how I caught the bug of the internet to begin with. And that's actually where I met Yat, who was the co-founder of Animoca Brands. And so we became friends in the late 90s in our journey to trying to build cool stuff on the internet and convinced the world that the internet was going to be a thing. And luckily, lots of other people were engaged in that too, so it wasn't up to us. And then I spent a decade in traditional media, as I think I mentioned to you earlier. You know, and this was my second startup, which I did with a couple of friends, and we rolled up ad-supported media assets, predominantly in China. So magazines, TV, outdoor, a little bit of radio. And that was at a period of time when China's media landscape was starting to open up a little bit. Mm-hmm. It was a what Americans in basketball call a head fake. So it was a lot of lip service towards opening, which attracted a lot of foreign investment, and then ultimately the door closed shut again a few years later. But we were in a little bit of a golden period when particularly licensed foreign content was very attractive in China. So I was involved in launching foreign magazine titles, some you know you might be familiar with here in the UK, like Top Gear or like Digital Camera and these kind of T3, etc. Consumer magazines. And then also really focused on the idea of consolidating ad buying power across lots of different media platforms, because this was at a period when the Chinese consumer spending was skyrocketing in the early 2000s. So I think we did that quite successfully for a period. And that's when after I sold that business or exited my position in the business, that's when Yat and I started talking about the gaming business.
Yeah.
Because to me, video games at that time, you know, I had played video games, but I'd never been in the industry. But, you know, with the advent of mobile, video games became a really interesting media to me because it kind of represented the culmination of kind of all the bits and pieces that I'd done before. Because I started out my career in telecoms, and mobile is that, obviously. But also games are entertainment. Their advertising, their media, their internet, there's lots of different things going on in a single product, and that really intrigued me.
Yeah.
And so we built mobile free-to-play video games for many years, and then as we were looking for new technologies to kind of spur our growth in the mobile game business, we discovered blockchain in 2017.
And the rest is history.
So. Well, we're still rewriting the history to make ourselves look good, but yes.
Do you think that, do you feel a similarity with the way that blockchain is being adopted as to like your early experience of the internet? Does it like feel like it's rhyming somewhat?
100%. I think that's why as kind of middle-aged guys, we had a little bit of an advantage when we entered the space because we were very quick to get conviction for the idea of tokenization.
Yeah.
Because coming from the lens of gaming, it made absolute sense to us because when you think about what a game, a typical game is in, you know, 2017 or 2024, it's a consumer product where people spend money to buy virtual currency inside a game and then they spend the virtual currency to buy virtual items.
Yeah.
Most of gaming revenue comes from the sale of virtual items. And so the world, you know, the 5 billion people around the world that play video games all completely understand what it means to buy virtual goods using virtual currency, and they believe in the value of virtual goods, right? They believe in that intellectual property value. And so the idea of just replacing those fictitious virtual goods with actual tokenized goods that you can truly own independently of the game and trade and have digital ownership and autonomy over, that was really exciting to us. It seemed like a no-brainer.
Yeah.
And so to go back to your question, once we had that conviction, we felt that was obvious. We looked at the adoption of blockchain and we could see an absolute pattern because if you look at, you know, the number of blockchain wallets 3 years ago, it was roughly akin to the number of web browsers in use in 1998, right? Back at a time when, you know, we were banging on about how great the internet was, but your average person was still like, well, what can I do with this internet?
Yeah.
Yes, I can do some searching on Yahoo and stuff, but it's not like I'm going to buy clothes on the internet. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I can't try them on.
Yeah, exactly right. But
right?
It's not the case. I think it's, we did a study at a company I worked at, and this was probably 8 or 9 years ago now, maybe 10, where we interviewed a bunch of people and it was like, would you rather lose your phone forever or lose a finger forever. it was your pinky finger, so it wasn't that useful.
Not a core finger.
No, it wasn't a thumb. I think it was something like 45% of people were like, take the finger. My phone is my on-ramp to the internet. I couldn't possibly live without it, but you know what? I don't need this. And I'm sure that number's probably got higher since then. That was a decade.
So I heard a funny analogy to this yesterday, actually. I was listening to a radio show and they were saying that, because it never occurred to me, but, you know, people of my generation, when you press a doorbell, you tend to use your index finger.
Yeah, okay.
But apparently younger people who've really grown up on video games and smartphones often use their thumb because they're used to pressing everything with their thumbs. Anyway, don't know if it's true, but...
To go back to your point on gaming, because I completely agree with you. It makes, like, I have bought FIFA points in the past. I've spent money on apps. It makes sense to me. My, I guess, counterpoint to that is that, like, do you think the large game developers are incentivized to let that happen, given that it's, like, take FIFA, for example.
Yep.
You play Ultimate Team, you get a load of FIFA points, you build your team, and then the next season, FIFA or EA wouldn't necessarily want you to just transfer all of that value that you accrued in the previous game to the new game, and they have an incentive to say, actually, there's new players now, stats have changed, do what you did again this season.
Yep.
Like, do you think it's going to be hard to get developers to break that cycle?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because there is an inherent bias towards the status quo of any large organization, right? Nobody ever wants to innovate in a way that sort of exhibits risk when you are already arguably the monopoly or the oligopoly in your industry. And we see that across many industries. And so I think, and let's take video games as a typical example. Video games generally undergo a platform change every decade or so, right? From consoles to PCs to mobile, whatever it is, handheld devices. And every time there's a platform change, essentially the kings, quote unquote, of the new platform are new emergent companies who are like native experts in that platform, not the companies who were the dominant in the previous platform because they see that as too risky.
Yeah.
So if you look at mobile, for example, all of the big console titles only started to come to mobile more than a decade after, frankly, the whole world was playing mobile games, right? And the companies we associate with mobile, like King, who make Candy Crush, or Supercell, who make Clash of Clans, or even Epic with Fortnite, you know, Minecraft, none of these things are things that we would associate with console, right? And they're the masters of the new platform. And I think we'll see the same thing when it comes to Web3 gaming, you know, and we've seen a lot of those companies like Sky Mavis, who makes Axie Infinity, for example. So I think there's that element to it, but I don't think that should hold back companies from pursuing that, because there's a huge opportunity there, but it's often difficult to articulate. So one of the ways that I like to explain it, and I think in this case, you can think about loyalty. So typically, one of the big analogies that people use for loyalty are airline reward points, because that's one of those loyalty schemes everybody is familiar with.
Yes.
Yeah. And you would think that airline loyalty reward schemes are something that you would want to keep as a walled garden, because you're like, well, I want to issue my points, but you can't use my points anywhere else, because this is how I'm going to hook you onto my service, and you're going to be stuck using my airline forever because you've accumulated all those points, and that's how I ensure your loyalty. But if you think about it, that also constrains the ability to grow the pie, because it's a little bit like free trade, right? If you think about how countries work, generally the pie of global trade increases the lower the tariffs and barriers there are to people interoperating amongst each other. And I would argue the same thing would be true with airline reward points, because if we had more fungibility, to use a Web3 term, amongst airline reward points, I actually think people would travel more.
Yeah.
Right? Because now I can use my points to go anywhere. Well, I'm going to take a flight. And guess what happens when you take a flight? You're going to earn more points. Mm. And then you're going to use more points, et cetera, et cetera. And then you also open up the potential for financial innovation.
Yeah.
Right? And this is what we've seen in Web3. So all of a sudden, once you have a free market for points, instead of saying points, I'll say utility tokens per airline, right? Then what happens? Somebody steps in and says, I think that Emirates is undervalued versus Singapore Airlines. Mm. So I'm going to make a market in that and take a position, and I'm going to buy a bunch of Emirates points.
Yeah.
Right? Is that good or bad for the airline? Mm. Right? So all that innovation can start to take place once you have slightly more open and interoperable systems.
Yeah. And it allows the airline in your example to like own more of the secondary market. Like you've mm-hmm. seen it. Rolex have done it recently, like they never sold pre-owned watches, and now they do sell pre-owned watches because they saw what was happening on the grey market, particularly mm-hmm. in the last 4 years. And I think that, and I've even bought points before, and it's like someone that you've met on Telegram, and they're like, yeah, I send you money, you send me points. I'm like, this feels weird already. Like,
that sounds really safe.
Yeah, it just sounds bizarre. And to be fair, like I got the points, so like it's a good service, but why would an airline not allow that to happen, you know, like particularly if you're like,
totally
a large family and you want to like, okay, I'm gonna fly in whatever class it is, I'd like my kids to fly with me, I'll just buy the points to get them the seat as opposed to just stumping up for a massive seat for a small kid.
Exactly. Know? Concert tickets, the other one, right? Everybody says, well, why are there all these scalpers, why don't they just make a secondary market so that I can get rid of the tickets I can no longer use, you know?
Yeah, we like 4 or 5 years ago, like we, I don't know if anyone's done this since, but I was like, it would be great if like an upcoming artist like tokenized themselves and like early investors could help them pay for their first bit of studio time, and that token entitled you to free tickets or like a future sale of the royalty, you know, like just allow that to happen so you're going to break away from what can go quite wrong when a record label gets involved. And I think it's one of those things that it's starting to happen slowly, and then it's like all of a sudden everyone will be like, why didn't we do this 10 years ago? And I think that it feels like with the change in government in the US, I think that was very much like holding blockchain like underwater as a basketball. And now it feels like it's been let go somewhat mm-hmm. because it was, they're one of the biggest markets in the world, right? If not the biggest. And that people tell you, you've even seen it in the UK recently, right? Like the US became much more bullish on crypto, and the UK like, oh, we're doing that as well. And it's like, well, you could have been doing that 2 years ago and stolen the march, but perhaps they weren't quite brave enough. But the Stand With Crypto guys doing a lot to help that. And I think it does feel like the early 2000s where the internet was kind of feels like where we're at now with blockchain.
For sure. The temperament and the climate in the US has a lot to do with sentiment, just because they are an outsized influence on both technology culture as well as just being the largest financial market.
Yeah.
I think also that a lot of those innovative sort of experiments, as you said, you know, artists allowing people to crowdfund their artistic journey or things like that, mm-hmm. Have been constrained by fear of what people have seen in terms of overreaching regulation in the absence of clear regulation.
Yeah, certainly. Yes, we've even seen it in kind of the work we do day to day. We were one of the first people that tested our exchange, was AWS. So they buy a ton of media, as you can imagine, and they tested us kind of apples to apples versus Web 2 exchanges, if you want to call them that, but the traditional SSPs, probably familiar with some of them. And we were just significantly cheaper, and they were like, oh, this makes, why have we not done this before? And that then had like a ripple effect across their agency, and now a lot more of their brands are like, it makes sense. There's transparency. The fees are lower because you can distribute the costs of the infrastructure. And that, even that, with us talking to them nearly every day, has taken us 2-3 years to get to that point where they're now like, hey, we're ready to like really start scaling out the tests that we've been doing with you for 2 years. And I think that if that's true for us, it's probably true everywhere. And it's just going to be interesting to see how quickly it changes. I still think there's some like, you kind of mentioned it with the platform side of things. They're like some killer bit of hardware that hasn't been invented yet. Or maybe it has, maybe it's not even hardware that will again, like change behaviors like mobile phones did. But I wish I knew what it was. I don't know what it is. I don't think it's the goggles, but I might be wrong there.
I would argue that it's not going to be hardware, because hardware adoption is too difficult. And we all lucked out with the smartphone because frankly, we still call it a smartphone, even though it's more smart than phone. But it did have the original killer app, which was that people intended to make phone calls with it. And that's kind of how we ended up getting it at scale into people's hands. But I think despite the fact we've seen it, it's the only thing of its kind aside from the PC itself over the 20 years prior to that that we've seen as an innovation.
Yeah.
I don't think we're going to see anything at similar scale to that. Because obviously we even saw the tablet never reach quite the same kind of conceptual scale. But I do think that the innovation will come from network effects of the propagation of the utility of the software.
Yeah,
and that's where the excitement is going to come. Because, and I wanted to go back to something that you said earlier, because I'm not going to let you off the hook on this one, which is about using stablecoins in your environment rather than thinking about having a native utility token, which you do have.
Yeah.
You know, and this is something that we talk about a lot in terms of our overall, not just investing strategy, but how we feel one should be building in Web3, which is we feel everybody, you know, where warranted should have a native utility token because it allows, it's a tool you can have in your arsenal to make use of codifying the network effects of your business that would be an opportunity cost if you didn't take advantage of it. Mm-hmm. So in your case, you know, you have a utility token which can be used for consumption of your services, but the more touch points you have in your business, the bigger your client base, the bigger your media partners and advertising partners, the bigger that network becomes, then the more broadly distributed your token becomes, the more decentralized. And over time, the more value of that network then accrues to the token. And that has a benefit for everybody actually who's in that network.
Correct, yeah.
And so while there may be concerns over volatility in the price of any kind of token that has a public market for that price, you know, I think that obviously you can find ways in your business to mitigate against whatever the cost of advertising is, which may be less volatile.
Yeah.
But I think as your business grows, it's a great way for you to also have to reward and incentivize and retain your customer base who also see a benefit in sharing in those network effects through being stakeholders in your network.
Certainly, yeah. I think this is one thing that we, is our, I'd say our biggest challenge at Alchemy is that the people that support the network, so the validators that we have, there's 1,200 now on the network, don't necessarily use the exchange to buy and sell ads. Advertisers and publishers do. But the thing that ties them together quite neatly is that everyone's been on the internet. And if you've been on the internet, you've been exposed to an ad. So you have your three customers, as it were. They just have slightly different entry points into the market. And I think one thing that previous blockchain ad tech companies have done, because we're not the first to, like Brave has done a very good job with their browser. You've had projects like Veracity that have their proof of view for determining whether someone's real or not that's watched a video. One thing that I think they could have perhaps done slightly better, which is, okay, there's people that spend a ton of money on advertising. They're the biggest brands in the world, they're the biggest websites in the world. They have a very distinct way of doing things. And you really have to, it's been a mantra of ours, that we wanted to meet the market exactly where it was and then kind of help them come towards where we think it should go. And I think that that Venn diagram, if you want to call it that, has kind of started to come closer together. But fundamentally, the businesses that we deal with, some of them still create newspapers. Some of them buy ads on those newspapers. So it's like quite unique in that you have technology that is hundreds of years old with technology that is brand new, all happening within the same building. And it's actually an important part of the way that brands reach their customers. You know, like I think you can't say for certain. You can. I actually got in trouble with this last week. A friend of mine is chief strategy officer at Adam and Eve, and he told me off for saying this. But I don't really think you can measure the impact of outdoor advertising.
Dare you?
Yeah, he said you could, and I was like, sorry, you would know. But people still spend money on it,
of course.
Whereas you can, and I think this is what I always thought was because I used to do a lot of work with King and Candy Crush. I think one year they bought like 2/3 of all of the available mobile inventory because they, with a device ID, had like a really tight attribution model. They knew exactly how much to spend and when to spend it to get their install, and they had a value for each user.
Yep.
And I remember one year they started putting the gummy bears on top of phone boxes in London. And I was like, how can a business that knows how tight its attribution model is then spend money on outdoor advertising? Like, because obviously somewhere someone said this is going to work. Maybe it didn't. I don't
know. I have an answer for that.
Okay, yeah.
Just it's the same reason they put ads on TV.
True.
It's because they exhausted the internet.
Yep.
There was nobody left on the internet for them.
Which is a good and bad problem to have.
And so then they had to go after a demographic that was old enough to not really be online.
Mm.
But they're still on TV.
True, yeah. And we're seeing a bit of a revival.
That's a high-class problem to have. Yeah, you've exhausted the internet.
Bought all the ads you can buy on the internet. Like, start looking elsewhere. But I think that the attribution model is cool. I think it's something that is now somewhat under threat. I think Apple made the very wily move of saying, okay, you can't access the device IDs anymore because we know we have a very valuable audience. I think businesses like Meta are quite lucky that Apple never quite nailed ads. Maybe they will, maybe they won't.
Yep.
But I think that's where a wallet, particularly in games that Adam Oka develops, have a really nice way to offer a tight attribution model. Like, we've often talked about wallets as a replacement for a cookie or a device ID. And I wonder if that's anything that you speak to developers about or something you're looking at. I'd be quite keen to know.
I think there are a few ways to implement this technically.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, it's with a little schadenfreude that we see, you know, Meta and Facebook, these guys reacting to what Apple's done, because frankly, it's just the same thing they've been doing to everybody else.
Yeah.
But Apple just walled the garden a little bit higher.
They did, yeah. A few extra breaks, yeah.
And, but I think that attribution is very important.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that the generation that was okay with sharing all of their personal information in exchange for quote unquote free services,
yeah,
has come to an end.
I'd agree.
And so I think that the current newer entrant generation, if you will, I don't think they're going to put up with that anymore. And now we're able to offer them the ability to have privacy and yet figure out how they can be in control of the value exchange of their personal information in exchange for what?
Yeah.
Because we have blockchain-based tools that allow us to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And we can get wonky and talk about zero-knowledge proofs and that kind of stuff.
Yep.
But I think that, as you said, whether it's a wallet or a soulbound token or some kind of tokenized identifier, ideally with KYC behind it as well, because we're living in a world now where the signifier that you have, that decentralized identity, has the ability to access regulated financial services as well as typical consumer services. I think that's a really powerful thing because
I agree with you.
At the end of the day, when you can provide that attribution, what you're going to do is you're going to change the user onboarding model from, you know, vast big funnels with huge marketing spend to push people into big funnels to distill small numbers of users that have relatively low value, to more moderate size funnels where you're going to get users at the end that have really high value.
Yeah.
Because those users are going to be completely bought into and voluntarily consuming of your services.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll see the ARPU go through the roof.
Yeah.
And I think we see that already in gaming, because gaming is a little bit more sort of an early adopter audience within this ecosystem.
Yeah.
And the people we see coming through our Web3 gaming funnels are spending on, you know, on the order of 100 times magnitude in terms of average revenue per user.
Yeah.
And at the same time, their retention rates go from, you know, in mobile gaming, we would expect a 7-day retention rate of like single digit percent at best.
Yeah.
5% of the users sticking around after 7 days. Whereas now we see 50, 60, 70% of the users sticking around after 30 days.
Okay.
And why are they sticking around? Because the value proposition to them is different.
Mm.
They own tokens. They're stakeholders in the network of the product. And when you have a stake in the product, you have a different approach towards value.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that if I ask you, you know, how much are you going to spend to renovate the kitchen in the flat that you rent?
Mm-hmm.
You'll be like, well, as little as I can, because you're not renovating it for you. You're renovating it for your landlord.
Mm.
But if you own the flat, you're like, well, whatever I can afford, because it's my flat, right? So ownership actually changes the proposition of retention, I think, in that respect.
Yes, certainly. I actually, I met Ilya from Motiverse,
mm-hmm.
and some of the stuff they're talking about doing with cars and yes. just like the driving behind it, and then like being able to lease out certain parts or like create certain, I'm like, that again, for what is a very fanatical car audience, that makes a ton of sense. You know, like their virtual car won a virtual tournament, you know, that's a cool thing to then own. And I think it's exactly what you're saying. It's just like you would then stick around because you have something that not only has value to you but has value to other people. And I think that's perhaps some of the point that the large developers are missing, is mm-hmm. that you're forcing people to buy new games, so they are quite transient with the ownership they feel of certain things they generate. Because you see on YouTube kids that are like, I'm just going to sit and grind and get the camos for this sniper. But if it was like a particular gun in a game that had like completed a mission with a perfect score, like that becomes like an artifact almost, which is...
Absolutely. Which has cultural import, and that's what gives it value. So it has value for its... actual utility. I can still use it in the game, but it also has value because, you know, there's only one of these, or everybody within this community recognizes that this is the one that won the, you know, certain battle or tournament or whatever.
Yeah, it's why like golfers sign the flag of the tournament they won, right? And mm-hmm. like it's why the ball that Messi scored a hat trick with is more valuable than just any other ball.
Exactly. It's
just digitalizing it, which is, it's cool. So I do, just get to talk about stuff like this, you know, it's pretty awesome. I'd like to bring it back to advertising a little bit. Like, what role do you think it has to play in this, like, future gaming universe that you are kind of helping build?
I think what's going to happen with advertising is that it's going to continue to bifurcate more between, let's call it, brand display advertising that has a relatively... light touch of call to action,
mm-hmm.
and advertising that's really going to be much higher cost, that is much more performance oriented, and can be extremely granular. Mm-hmm. And this is also what I encourage some of when we think about, you know, in the Web3 community, the airdrop mechanic has been quite popular over the last year, where you reward participants in your ecosystem with an airdrop of tokens. But I think those campaigns, and this is what I've been encouraging our portfolio companies to do, need to be much more fine-tuned, mm-hmm. meaning you don't just give them an airdrop for showing up.
Yeah.
You give them an airdrop because they've performed 10 actions, mm-hmm. you know, that you think are essential to the health of your ecosystem, mm-hmm. or that are in the onboarding funnel where you've basically taken 10 bites at the apple to... convince them to become a retained user of your actual core product through this. And you're giving them that incentive to say, try this, try that, try all these things, because after you try these 10 things, there's a much higher probability you will stick around because you're enjoying the gameplay or you're enjoying whatever the, you know, the underlying utility is.
Do you think that continues to scale as that proves successful for companies? You know, like, there becomes a point where you, like Candy Crush again, for example, like you've exhausted the performance side of it, and now it is just reminding people of the brand it is. And I think we're doing a lot of work with Coca-Cola, and their general mm-hmm. strategy is we want to target people with mouths, which kind of gives them quite a broad audience of like everyone. And that's what they've nailed, is like maintaining that. They probably didn't at some point, but like now you kind of get to a tipping point where it's like, hey, we just have to do brand advertising now, because it's the same reason you want to be on a Formula One car, right? Like, that is an important place to be, or sponsor a football team, whatever it is. But there's somewhere, like, there's performance and there's branding, and there's like a little space in between. I think that is crypto or Web3 is not great at doing that. It's, I always joke and say, you either work with the KOL or you sponsor a football team, and there's not a huge amount in between. I think that's where a lot of the maturity in this sector is going to come from, is mm-hmm. like figuring out how you get from Twitter to wherever it is, Red Bull Racing. You know, like, there's something in between, but it seems to you like go in here or you come in here. You don't do the bit in the middle necessarily. And I wonder what that inflection point is, where it's like, hey, we've done this now. Is there like a number in your mind, or is it, how would you, and when would you recommend someone goes, okay, that worked, now this is where we go to really...
So I think that within the Web3 community, the vast majority of, in my opinion, advertising and marketing spending should be towards things that are performance oriented,
yeah.
things that are driving the growth of your core product, because most people are still in reasonable startup mode,
mm-hmm.
meaning they're not mature businesses.
Yeah.
And so the growth of client and user base is paramount.
Mm-hmm.
I think that brand building is better served through, let's call it, the grind of brand building,
mm-hmm.
meaning demonstrating thought leadership,
yep.
Speaking at events, being out there and participating strategically in communities,
mm-hmm.
Partnerships and alliances, and showing yourself to be a kind of a competent steward. Because I think one of the things in a sort of a nascent space like we have is that it takes a while for companies to build credibility, and that's yeah. just a function of time.
Yeah.
And okay. so I think that brand building happens through kind of durability, that here's somebody who, irrespective of market volatility and trends, has, you know, they're a business, they have a thesis, they've got a 3-5 year plan, and they're trying to build, right? As opposed to kind of just flapping in the wind
yeah.
like a flag, which a lot of people do because there's a lot of trend-driven activity as well.
Certainly, yeah.
In this space. So I think on the brand side, you can advertise to support that, but I actually think most of the meat should come through kind of working on the brand and building the reputation. And most of your ad spend should actually be in, okay, so should we do an airdrop campaign? Should we do a KOL campaign? Should we do a traditional ad campaign to drive users in because, you know, our main thing is a mobile app and we can do mobile ad spend to bring users in?
Yeah, I think we've often looked at Web3 brands that we'd like to work with. So we've done work with Bybit, so kind of like we'll work with Kraken next year. But some other smaller projects have come to ask me and say, like, can we run a campaign on your exchange? I'm like, just don't do it, because you won't believe the amount of money that you have to spend to get scale that's actually going to move the needle. It's like, well, $5,000 do it? I'm like, probably not. No, like, that's not a lot of ad impressions, really, because there's billions, you know, trillions every single month. You're barely going to touch the sides with 5,000. You may as well not spend it. You know, I could like reasonably say, okay, yeah, spend the money. And then they're like, what happened? I'm like, you spent the money with us. That's what happened. Like, I don't know what you're expecting. And I think that's where we've lent towards the Web2 side of things, because they're further down. Well, some of them are a lot further down that funnel. And like, there is value to them spending a lot of money on.
Yes.
Having brands on the right publications, like, there is this like notion of an editorial halo, you know, like if you're against good content, then your brand is perceived better.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think Web3 is quite there yet. Some brands are, as I mentioned, like the larger exchange of people that have been around for a long time. But I'm excited for when more of those businesses start to move into that funnel, just because they will have this huge audience of wallet holders. I mean, there's a lot to be said for not even knowing who someone is, but knowing they have a token.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I always think that like WeTransfer for me is a great idea for something that like a Uniswap could become. Like, you go to that platform, you are there for a period of time whilst you're swapping something, and you're connecting a wallet. So Uniswap would know that you might have had Chainlink or a Pudgy Penguin or whatever it is, and then a brand can use that big screen as an interstitial to tell you about how great their brand is. It's like, WeTransfer did this very successfully, because you have to wait for a long time as it uploads, slightly shorter time, but ads have an impact, and then it kind of decays over time. And I just think that I wonder, as like users start to plateau for products that have done really well, ad spend will then come in. Like, I think OpenAI were talking about it today, right? Where it's like, think about using ads now, and I'm like, that tells me that their user numbers have kind of started to flatten off a little bit, because if their user numbers are still going up, they'd be like, we don't care, we've got subscriptions. You've seen it with Netflix, you know, you've seen it with other AVOD platforms, and I think it'll be exciting for when Web3 platforms and dApps get to that point as well, just because of the wealth of data that doesn't attach itself to an individual, just a wallet that can be used to then provide really performant advertising, and maybe bridge that bifurcation that you were saying. It's like, you can use a brand but get performance because you can tie it to this wallet that lives forever.
Well, and I also think that people in this space really need to focus on brand building, because brand building is durable. And in a space where so many things are fleeting and volatile, and where, you know, ironically we pat ourselves on the back for using technology that's supposed to be trustless.
Yeah.
But in fact, nobody trusts anybody in this space it's rife with scams.
Yeah.
That actually building a brand is really important because if you think about like what a bank is, a bank is really a brand.
Yeah, true.
Because you have a level of trust that you deposit money and it will be safe. And it'll be safe because there's regulation, because there's a big physical building with a safe in it and stuff like that. But really, you're trusting the brand.
Yeah,
and true. There is not a bank in the world that has been untarnished by scandal at some point. And they invest a lot of money in brand building to make sure that they're seen as a trustworthy steward of your funds. And I think that that's something that, you know, the Web3 community would be well served to keep in mind.
I think so, yeah, because you've, like, I think Doodles is a good example of that. You know, like, they had their partnership with McDonald's recently, which even 4 years ago probably seemed like light years away, but like have continued to build their brand. And then you had Pudgy Penguins that made it into Walmart. You know, that's just, for me, it's just IP that they've, again, shared some ownership of. So you've got, out of nowhere, really, I think it shortens that time for you to become like a super fan of something. You know, like it took Harry Potter, for example, like it took the time it took, whatever it was, to write all the novels, and then people loved it, and then it became a film, and then it became a Lego, and then it became a theater, and then it became a theme park, you know, like that. You could significantly shorten that time if people get to share in some of that value accrual from its inception.
For sure.
Which perhaps might make it also just slightly transient if something bigger and shinier comes on and there's a chance to capture more value. But I think equally, if you do a good enough job, you will capture those people for a long period of time. So yeah, it's...
Well, and the interesting thing is because the technology is actually so much less expensive now that it's decentralized and the infrastructure is shared, that you have the ability to leverage that kind of infrastructure for things that are smaller, that service smaller communities. So I think a lot of the excitement here is actually the accessibility and inclusion aspect, where you'll be able to build brands with those kind of diverse networks across multimedia and multi-platforms, but for small audiences, right? So that, and we talk about this, you know, in Web3 from time to time, where, you know, you can build a business in Web3 based on 10,000 dedicated fans.
Yeah.
And, you know, in Web2, 10,000 people ain't going to get you very far, because, you know, when they're paying you 2 cents a month apiece, you need 50 million of them.
Yeah,
right?
True.
Whereas in Web3, when you have a dedicated core audience, that can be the place that sustains the business, and then you can build on top of that.
Yeah. It's true, actually, because I was looking, again, I was just, Doodles is my flavor of the day, because I was looking at it this morning. They've only got 4,445 holders, and that brand, that few, that half, 5,000 people, less than, has managed to secure a partnership with Pharrell Williams, with McDonald's, with Camp. You know, like, that's, they've leveraged their audience, like, about as good as you can.
Although,
you know?
I would speculate there are probably less Hermes Kelly bags than that in London.
Yeah.
So, similar concept.
That is very true, actually. Yeah, I think, but that, I think luxury takes a long time, you know.
Like, it does.
Like, that's like Maisons, you know, like, whereas Doodles is, 4 years, 5 years, you know, like that is a, so if, it's huge.
Let's just say if there was a very liquid market for handbags, there is a market, it's a little bit less liquid.
Yeah.
But if there was, maybe the timeline would be shorter.
True, yeah.
And it's because these are highly liquid digital products that facilitates the compression of that timeline.
Yeah.
But it is, at the end of the day, as we were talking about at the beginning, it is tokenized culture.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's...
Because if anything, you know, people like the way doodles look, but it's also social signaling.
Totally right. Yeah, yeah. I agree. And that's why I quite enjoyed about NFTs. I like dip to toe, and still one of my favorite ones. I got quite involved with the Memeland universe, and they just... I mean, they had like the pedigree from kind of the Facebook groups, but just like the way everything they did about it, just the design of it, kind of being very tongue in cheek, just they nailed it. I think it's absolutely amazing. And then there's like lots of stuff that's come off the back of it, like the artwork's stupid, but it's funny, you know, like the
15 years of being on the zeitgeist really gives them a feel for it.
Just even I was on, they've got this Stakeland website where you can like unlock, I think, meme coins, but they've just got like the old Super Mario logo. And I'm like, that is exactly what that should be. It's like really nice. And I think that, to back to your earlier point, is like the power of building quite a good brand, a very good brand in their instance. It's just that they've got tons of loyal holders that the price of it hasn't really changed. I don't really see it much changing hands. And I think they've given people a lot of stuff to poke thereafter, which has very much kept people engaged. We're probably coming up to another 12 to 18 months where we'll see the most engagement we've seen in blockchain for a very long time. Like what? I don't want to ask you about prices of anything because I don't think it really matters. But what do you think like will be like the theme of the next 12 to 18 months? My opinion is like this, like the adoption cycle where like people start to use this stuff more often. But yeah, I wonder what your thoughts are.
So I think Bitcoin has been the gift that keeps on giving for a while now.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. And for those of you listening who aren't in the Web3 space, Bitcoin is kind of our macroeconomic indicator.
Yeah.
So when things go well for the price of Bitcoin, generally everything in Web3 does better, even if it's already doing well. And so I think that we have a reasonable amount of headroom for Bitcoin over the next year because there seems to be a lot of positive sentiment in traditional financial markets for Bitcoin and the sort of digital asset category that it's created.
Yep.
So as long as that persists, then that gives us headspace to work in, you know, the rest of Web3 and build without too much negative sentiment.
Yeah,
people can raise capital from venture, they can build stuff, and that's great. I think that the most fun thing about this space is that whatever we think is going to happen by next summer will probably not be what happens and it'll be something else.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair.
And it's the unpredictability actually that I think keeps it really exciting. But I do agree with you. I think we're going to have much more widespread adoption. I think it's going to also be facilitated by much more heavy use of AI tools, specifically bots and AI assistants that help us navigate more complex technologies. A lot of what we've struggled with in recent years has been user onboarding experiences that were driven by a community that was highly technical at its core and enjoyed the technicality of it, but that's really an obstacle when it comes to less technical consumer audiences. But I think AI will actually leapfrog and help us solve those problems so that rather than having to have a really simple user interface that you navigate yourself, you'll just have an AI agent that you say, please help me do this, and it will do it for you.
I agree. I think it's going to allow for people to build really specific infrastructure because I think what we've been the benefits of, I think it kind of happens with anything, but like you have like you come to Ethereum and it's like you can build anything you want on Ethereum, but then if you're not quite sure what to build, it's like, well, what do I build? It's like, well, you can really build anything you want to build, and I think that is a massive barrier to entry. Like you have to understand why Ethereum and the intricacies of a smart contract and what that means and the risks that includes.
Well, it's like me giving you a big stack of paper and saying, okay, now write a novel.
And I think just like now where
you got the paper.
And I need, well, it is a pen, right? And then Harry Potter. But I think just being able to get over that with an agent that knows the pitfalls, but still requires some expertise. And so not everyone is doing it. There's like at least the people that know something can do stuff that's good, not just like walking off the street and being like, I'm going to build a restaking platform. You know, this probably won't happen. But that kind of specific infrastructure, and I think Story Protocol have been talking a lot about this, and I kind of borrowed from that because we've been building specific infrastructure for a really long time, which is just like ours is going to be used to bring the buying of ads on chain. And then let's see what happens when capital is way more efficient when you buy ads. Because I think a lot of the reason that large branding budgets don't, like, this, to go to my point about $5,000 not touching the sides, like, one of the reasons behind that is if you just spent it on another Web2 exchange, half of that's going to go to the person that's supposed to be buying the media for you. So your budget's only $2,500. And then if you want to do some IBT or ID matching or some contextual targeting, like your $5,000 very quickly gets whittled down to $1,000 and you're literally buying a million ads, which you wouldn't even realize, you wouldn't see any yourself, you know. So that is what I'm excited about, is to see like the specific solutions that people create to different challenges, like even more broadly than just like, even what we're doing is quite broad, but like the specific, so like someone comes to us and say, we figured out this really neat way to solve for purchase intent for high street brands, whatever it may be, and this is how we think it can slot into what you've built. And I think that will start to become really cool, because you can spin up really quickly, you can test it on the wealth of on-chain data that there is,
mm-hmm.
get it really tight really quickly, and then prove value to people that want to buy it and like solve someone's actual problem, rather than being like, hey, anything, you can solve all the problems.
Yes.
Come to Ethereum or Solana or wherever it is, you know. Yeah. So I'm quite excited to see that play out over the next, hopefully more than 12 to 18 months, I think.
Well, and the fun part is, as you build that infrastructure, I think the fun part about Web3 is I think it's our job as people who build some of this infrastructure to demonstrate to people how it might be used.
Yeah, certainly.
But suggest that's not the sum total of how it should be used. And that actually, here you go, here are some tools, but guess what? You can kind of do whatever you want with it.
Yeah.
So actually what it might end up being used for is actually something completely different,
mm-hmm.
but very exciting nonetheless, because actually, you know, everything becomes a user-generated content platform.
Yeah.
In a sense, you know,
certainly.
And your clients and your customers and stuff may actually be the ones who develop things that provide more innovation that everybody starts using, right?
I think, yeah, to speak, I guess, specifically on Alchemy, that attitude to the way that we're building the network fundamentally sets our trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're just like, only you can come, only we are selling ads on our platform.
Yeah.
It's not a platform, it's an ad network.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you kind of like, we want people to be able to build their business on what it is that we've created, and we are a low fee, high volume game. So the more people building on it, the better. And that kind of allows us to change our trajectory and allow us to become much stickier. It's something that the Trade Desk did phenomenally well over the last 20 years. You know, like they have been around for a very long time, IPO'd and were like $8 billion as a company, and then like kind of gave up the managed service side of their business.
Mm-hmm.
Buying campaigns and running campaigns on behalf of their clients. Like, okay, we're just going to help agencies have scale of media buying across various platforms and make quite a nice UI. And then you roll on 5 to 6 years and they're $56 billion market cap. They're doing some pretty amazing things. It's like a really, and I'm like, okay, well, that's the model. It's just like, what can you do if you have infrastructure that allows for more of what made that really great? And I think mm-hmm. that's how we try and think about what it is that we're doing.
Because mm-hmm.
you can deploy any part of the ad serving, buying, auction application to the validator network.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, what does that look like? But again, as you say, we've got to show you how that works. And the analogy I always give is that, like, you know, you walk into a kitchen shop and it's like, here's all the kitchens we could make. And you're like, hey, I just want that kitchen. Or you're like, hey, come with us and we can tell you about the marble and the boiling water tap.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the hobs are, that's kind of where I want us to be. It's like, we are the Ren kitchens, as it were, and it's like, you can buy a kitchen from us or you can come and build your own kitchen, but
yeah,
we give you the bits for that kitchen, to really thrash that analogy to within an inch of its life.
It's okay, I did a renovation a few years ago. Okay. I'm with you.
Okay, nice. Yeah. I think, have you got any questions you want to ask me?
So I think, you know, based on your experience, how have you found the receptivity amongst advertisers and, like, let's call them advertisers and media providers,
yeah,
who are not typically Web3 native to what you're trying to do? And has it been, like, what have you found to be the biggest challenge there?
So I would say very broadly, it's kind of like two reactions. It's like lock in or allergic, basically. Mm-hmm. I think that was partly to do with the way that we were talking about it. So we were talking about the features of cheaper, transparent, energy efficient. And people are like, well, I don't really know what that means to me. I can't put that into a plan. I don't understand what that means for me if I'm selling ads. And for us, it was just about shaping a product for the buyers. So we, using the features of the exchange. So one thing that happens quite a lot is that people will buy a sponsorship of a website. Now, typically you have to do that directly with a publisher. It's quite expensive. It can be double-digit CPMs. But a lot of the ad units that you'd be serving in are largely commoditized. So it can be like MPUs that sit in the middle, or it can be the ones that kind of come around the outside, or add a full-page interstitial. So because our fees are so low, we submit really high bids into the auctions that people host, mm-hmm. which allowed us to win all of those ad units. Mm-hmm. And that was then 100% share of screen or 100% share of voice. Mm-hmm. So if then all of a sudden you're a portfolio brand and you are just an example, LVMH, you might have a luxury audience that you're looking to target, and Rimowa might be bidding against Louis Vuitton. You might be bidding against other LVMH brands and just kind of artificially increasing the cost of the media they're looking to purchase. But now they just win all the auctions on the page. So there's no way, without there having to be deduplication and a ton of extra information being sent in the bid, it's like, hey, we just win all the ads now and it's cheaper than us going directly. And some publishers don't even want to run those high impact pages. It's just like a nice way for them to, we're the only brand on page, or we can tell a nice message like, here's our brand, here's what it does, buy it here, as you kind of go through that content mm-hmm. journey on page. So I think framing it in a way for them to understand what it was they were buying was a big, big difference for us. Mm-hmm. And I think then just factors outside of our control really were, there's been a big push, maybe it started 5 years ago, but has really been gathering momentum in the last 2 or 3 years since two landmark studies. So ANA is a body in America that looked at the supply path between a buyer and a seller of an ad, and then ISBA did it in the UK, and generally just saw that 43%, well, firstly, they're only able to match 5% of all the impressions from buyer to seller. So already the data set is quite small, and this was basically done manually. So it's like, not that one, not that one, not that one, that one yep. looks right. And kind of that was what made it into the audit. And of those impressions they were able to match, 43% was lost. And that 43% has like resonated with brands who are like, it's expensive for us to produce our goods. It's tough for us to acquire customers because they're not spending any money anymore. And now I'm reading that 43% of our marketing budget is being wasted on this channel. And that was a key part in what helped us really win the Coca-Cola business, to be honest with you, was that they wanted to understand how their money's being spent. They firstly wanted to consolidate the partners down. And then there's this notion of supply path optimization. And in my opinion, if your source to buy media is on-chain and immutable, that's just an optimized supply path. You don't really need to do much else than that because you have data that you can verify. You don't need to trust it. And you can see exactly who took the fees, why they were taken, for what, and where those ads were shown with 100% certainty if that's what took place. So that those two main factors have been, okay, I'm getting pushed to prove more value in this channel because we still believe that it works. Mm-hmm. So we want to look at alternative solutions.
Yep.
And then creating something that's easy for them to purchase mm-hmm. has been quite key. And then the last point was that we built our own layer two so we could have our own custom consensus mechanism, which was using OpenRTB, which is the way in which ads are bought online, just like expected strings of data that could be read by the Web2 endpoints either side of that. So we could just say, you don't need to change much with what you're doing. Infrastructure that's better. And even after all of that effort, some people are just like, I got scammed on Solana once. I don't want to do this anymore. You can come back to me later. Or they're just like, we just spend money on print and that works really well for us. You know, like some brands do that really effectively. Some brands still haven't like taken the jump into digital advertising across the board. So when you start talking about blockchain, they're like, hey, whoa, no. I like magazines. I like TV. I like radio.
Yeah.
And that's what I do. So some of them just aren't there yet. But yeah, I would say they were the main three things. And just the kind of general, it was a rough 4 years, right? Like you had Luna and then FTX and like a very aggressive SEC and like, whoa. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, BlackRock are doing this. I talk about this a lot. It's like, it's been adopted by the financial mainstream and they yep. tend to like set the tone. And then other people are like, okay, this kind of makes sense. Like, what is that? And then it's in the news more. So like what we see with the people that really love it is that like maybe they're into crypto. Mm-hmm. We arrive in their office and they're like, oh shit, I've been seeing this on the news. This is like something I'm interested personally is now collided into my day job.
Yes.
I'm going to lead into that a bit more.
Well, and I think also it takes a bit of time for us to, as an industry, to kind of hone our pitch to really remember to get over ourselves.
Yeah, totally.
And that really what we're talking about here is,
couldn't agree with you more,
some infrastructure. And most of the time, unless you're a utility, mm-hmm. you don't lead your sales pitch with, check out my infrastructure.
Because
that's exactly not what gets people excited. Yeah. Infrastructure ideally should just be better, faster, cheaper. And mm-hmm. that's and out of sight and out of mind more than anything else.
Yeah.
Yes. And so I think that we're getting better now, finally, at stressing the fact that, well, actually, you should use this because it's cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it cheaper? Well, let me tell you about decentralization,
yep.
right? But fundamentally, it's just cheaper and we can maintain, you know, your service much cheaper and more securely because we have this technical innovation over here.
Exactly right. And sometimes it's like when you say to someone it's cheaper, they're like, sweet.
Yeah.
And that's the end of the conversation. And then you just prove that it works. And
exactly.
Like, how did you do that? It's like with the blockchain, they're like, cool, that's good enough for me,
and,
you know?
And look at just marketplaces for things like NFTs, for example, right? NFT marketplaces with full market forces available to them to decide whatever commissions and fees they want to have the market settled on 2%.
Yeah.
I mean, the market in mobile apps settled on 30%.
Yep.
How did that happen, right?
Yeah.
And it's because we're so efficient that actually these businesses can make money based on 2%.
Exactly right, yeah. And I think it's a really poor way to convince people to use something new is if you go to the market and say, what you're doing is stupid. You should do what I'm doing. And
yes.
They're like, no, it isn't. You're stupid. And then it's like, well, where do you go from there? You know, and I think that, well, you're doing it wrong. It's like, well, I'm not doing it wrong because, like, look at all this evidence of me doing it right. Like,
yes.
You guys are like this, you know, we're like, then it's just not the way to do it. You have to...
Yeah.
Say it in a way they understand and then solve the problem.
Yes.
And that, I think, is what people should lead more with. It's just like, here's how we solve your problems. And then, as I said, that can be enough a lot of the time. But if they're like, yes. Well, how do you do it? Because I want to understand this before I take a risk. And you're like, well, here's how. And then that's the route in. It's because they've already come at it from a fact like, this is solving a problem I have as part of my due diligence. I now want to understand it. And then they get exposed to the wonderful world of...
Exactly.
Centralization.
Exactly. And I think, and also all those sort of unintended consequences of what it's capable of. So, you know, you said Coca-Cola is looking for people with mouths.
Yeah.
But the exciting part is that it doesn't just have to end with you helping them, you know, create an ad which results in a purchase.
Mm.
It can also mean that they can create ads which are essentially marketing spend to build a community, which
Certainly.
Then become influencers.
Yeah.
That lead to multiple mouths per influencer buying the product because they put out a, you know, collectible NFT collection of NFTs that give you a discount on buying six packs of Coca-Cola.
Yeah, or like a special can, you know, like these doodles in McDonald's, like people
exactly
to McDonald's to get the doodles cup, you know, like that is a net benefit for McDonald's because they had to buy it from McDonald's, you know, so it's going to be interesting that for CERN, I think. And it's just, I think it's like big brands that have been around for a long time often don't seem that innovative at like first glance, but actually they're really good at innovating. They just do it deliberately when it makes sense to do it, and then they double down on
it.
And I think that's kind of where we're at. With
Well, and also they always have really creative, innovative people inside.
Yeah.
And those are the people who are trying to pitch to the committees that typically kill everything.
Yeah, that is very true. Like, how much does it cost?
And that's just a corporate problem.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah. All right, Robbie, I think we'll leave it there. We've been chatting for a while now. I've thoroughly enjoyed that.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming down. I appreciate it. You're welcome.
Absolutely.
Back anytime.
Cool. Hey, anytime I can come and check out your cool studios here. Happy to join you.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Cheers.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
If you enjoyed that episode, there's many more on our YouTube channel, on our Spotify and Apple podcasts. To make sure you don't miss the next episode, make sure you have your notifications turned on so you can hear the next great conversation we have with our next guest.